standing at least 7 feet tall from sheer rage. There is the Privy Council looking quite aghast. You should have seen their faces. Thomas Stanley's mouth open like a fish, our brother Lionel clutching his cross on his chest in horror. There is George, squaring up to the king and bellowing his script like a mama. Of course it makes no sense to half of them, who don't realize George is doing the scaffold speech from memory like a strolling player. So when he says, "I am an old man, a wise man," they are all utterly confused. I give a little shriek of laughter. Anthony, they were not! I swear to you, we none of us knew what was happening except Edward and George. Then George called him a tyrant. My laughter abruptly dies. In his own council. A tyrant and a murderer. He called him that? Yes, to his face. What was he talking about? The death of Warwick? No, I say shortly. Something worse. Edward of Lancaster, the young prince? I shake my head. That was in battle. Not the old king. We never speak of it, I say. Ever. Well, George is going to speak of it now. He looks like a man ready to say anything. You know he is claiming that Edward is not even a son of the House of York. That he is a bastard to Blaiburn the archer. So that George is the true heir. I nod. Edward will have to silence him. This cannot go on. Edward will have to silence him at once, he warns me, or George will bring you and the whole House of York down. It is, as I said, your house's emblem should not be the white rose, but the old sign of eternity. Eternity, I repeat, hopeful that he is going to say something reassuring at this most dark time in our days. Yes, the snake which eats itself. The sons of York will destroy each other, one brother destroying another, uncles devouring nephews, fathers beheading sons. They are a house which has to have blood, and they will shed their own if they have no other enemy. I put my hands over my belly, as if to shield the child from hearing such dark predictions. Don't, Anthony, don't say such things. They are true, he says grimly. The House of York will fall, whatever you or I do, for they will eat up themselves. I go into my darkened bedchamber for the 6 weeks of my confinement, leaving the matter still unsettled. Edward cannot think what can be done. A disloyal royal brother is no new thing in England, no new thing for this family, but it is a torment for Edward. Leave it till I come out, I say to him on the very threshold of my chamber. Perhaps he will see sense and beg for a pardon. When I come out, we can decide. And you be of good courage. He glances at the shadowy room behind me, warm with a small fire, blank-walled, for they take down all images that might affect the shape of the baby waiting to be born. He leans forward. I shall come and visit you, he whispers. I smile. Edward always breaks the prohibition that the confinement chamber should be the preserve of women. Bring me wine and sweetmeats, I say, naming the forbidden foods. Only if you will kiss me sweetly. Edward, for shame! As soon as you come out, then. He steps back and formally wishes me well before the court. He bows to me, I curtsy to him, and then I step back and they close the door on the smiling courtiers, and I am on my own with the nurses in the small suite of rooms, with nothing to do but wait for the new baby to come. I have a long, hard birth, and at the end of it, the treasure, which is a boy. He is a darling little York boy, with scanty fair hair, and eyes as blue as a robin's egg. He is small and light, and when they put him in my arms, I have an instant pang of fear because he seems so tiny. He will grow, says the midwife comfortingly. Small babies grow fast. I smile and touch his miniature hand and see him turn his head and purse his mouth. I feed him myself for the first 10 days, and then we have a big-bodied wet nurse who comes in and gently takes him from me. When I see her seated in the low chair, and the steady way she takes him to her breast, I am sure that she will care for him. He is christened George, as we promised his faithless uncle, and I am churched, and I come out of my darkened confinement apartment into the bright sunshine of the middle of August to find that in my absence the new whore, Elizabeth Shaw, is all but queen of my court. The king has given up drunken bouts and womanizing in the bathhouses of London. He has bought her a house near to the Palace of Whitehall. He dines with her, as well as beds her. He enjoys her company, and the court knows it. She leaves tonight, I say briskly to Edward, when resplendent in a gown of scarlet embroidered with gold he comes to my rooms. Who? He asks mildly, taking a glass of wine at my fireside. No husband more innocent. He waves his hand, and the servants whisk from the room, knowing well enough that there is trouble brewing. The Shaw woman, I say simply. Did you not think that someone would greet me with the gossip as soon as I came out of confinement? The wonder is that they held their tongues for so long. I barely stepped out of the chapel door before they were stumbling over each other in their haste to tell me. Margaret Beaufort was particularly sympathetic. He chuckles. Forgive me. I did not know that my doings were of such great interest. I say nothing to this untruth. I just wait. Ah, beloved, it was a long time, he says. I know you were in your confinement, and then in your time of travail, and my heart went out to you. But nonetheless, a man needs a warm bed. I am out of confinement now, I say smartly, and you will have an icy bed. It will be a pillow of frost. It will be a counterpane of snow for you, if she is not gone by tomorrow morning. He puts out his hand to me, and I go to stand beside him. At once the familiar touch and the scent of his skin when I bend down to kiss his neck overwhelm me. Say you are not angry with me, sweetheart, he whispers to me, his voice a lulling coo. You know I am. Then say you will forgive me. You know I always do. Then say we can go to bed and be happy to be together again. You have done so well to give us another boy. You are such a joy when you are plump and newly returned to me. I desire you so much. Say we can be happy. No, you say something. His hand slides up my arm and circles my elbow under the sleeve of my nightgown. As always, his touch is as intimate as lovemaking. Anything. What would you have me say? Say that she is gone tomorrow. She is, he says with a sigh. But you know, if you would but meet her, you would like her. She is a joyful young woman, and well-read and merry. She is a good companion, and one of the sweetest-natured girls that I have ever met. She is gone tomorrow, I repeat, ignoring the charms of Elizabeth Shaw, as if I cared one way or another whether she was well-read, as if Edward cared, as if he had the capacity to tell the truth about a woman. He chases after women like a randy dog after a bitch in heat. I swear he knows nothing about their reading or their temperament. First thing, my darling. First thing. Summer, 1477. In June, Edward has George arrested for treason and brings him before the council. Only I know what it cost my husband to accuse his brother of plotting his death. His grief and his shame he kept hidden from everyone else. At the meeting of the Privy Council there is no evidence brought. There need be no evidence. The king himself declares that treason has been committed, and no one can argue with the king on such a charge. And indeed there is not a man there who has not had the sleeve of his jacket held by George in some dark passageway as George whispered his insane suspicions. There is not a man who has not heard the promise of advancement if he will make a party against Edward. There is not a man who has not seen George refuse any food prepared in any kitchen ordered by me, or throw salt over his shoulder before he sits down to dine at our tables, or clench his fist in the sign against witchcraft when I go by. There is not a man who does not know that George has done everything but write his own accusation of treason and sign his own confession. But none of them, even now, know what Edward wants to do about it. They find him guilty of treason, but they do not set a punishment. None of them knows how far this king will go against the brother he still loves. Winter, 1477. We celebrate Christmas at Westminster, but it is an odd Christmas, with George, Duke of Clarence, missing from his place in the hall, and his mother with a face like thunder. George is in the Tower, charged with treason, well served and well fed, drinking well, I don't doubt, but his namesake is in our nursery, and his true place is with us. I have all my children around me, which gives me all the joy that I could wish. Edward home from Ludlow, Richard riding with him, Thomas returned from a visit to the court of Burgundy, the other children well and strong, the new baby George in the nursery. In January, we celebrate the greatest marriage that England has ever seen, when my little Richard is betrothed to the heiress Anne Mowbray. The four-year-old prince and the little girl are lifted onto the table at their wedding feast in their beautiful miniature clothes, and they hold hands like a pair of little dolls. They will live apart until they are old enough to marry, but it is a great thing to have secured such a fortune for my boy. He will be the richest prince England has ever seen. But after Twelfth Night, Edward comes to me and says that his Privy Council are pressing him to make a final decision on the fate of his brother, George. "What do you think?" I ask. I have a sense of foreboding. I think of my three York boys, another Edward, Richard, and George. What if they were to turn against each other as these have done? "I think I have to go ahead," he says sadly. "The punishment for treason is death. I have no choice." Spring, 1478. "You cannot dream of executing him." His mother sweeps past me into Edward's privy chamber in her haste to speak to her son. I rise and sweep her the smallest curtsy. "My lady mother," I say. "Mother, I don't know what I should do." Edward goes on one knee for her blessing, and she rests her hand on his head absent-mindedly, by rote. There is no tenderness in her for Edward. She is thinking of no one but George. She dips a tiny curtsy to me and turns back to Edward. "He is your brother. Remember it." Edward shrugs, his face miserable. "Actually, he himself says he is not," I point out. "George claims that he is only Edward's half-brother, since he says that Edward is a bastard to an English archer on you. He traduces you as well as us. He is generous in his slanders. He does not balk at libelling any of us. He calls me a witch, but he calls you a whore." "I don't believe he says any such thing," she declares roundly. "Mother, he does," Edward replies, "and he insults me and Elizabeth." She looks as if this is not such a bad thing. "He undermines the House of York with his libels," I say, "and he employed a wizard to ill-wish the king." "He is your brother. You will have to forgive him," she declares to Edward. "He is a traitor. He will have to die," I say simply. "What else? Is it forgivable to plot the death of the king? Then why shouldn't the defeated House of Lancaster do it? Why shouldn't the spies from France? Why shouldn't any scum from the highway come with a knife against your finest son?" "George has been disappointed," she says urgently to Edward, ignoring me. "If you had let him marry the Burgundy girl, as he wanted, or let him have the Scots princess, none of this would have happened." "I couldn't trust him," Edward says simply. "Mother, there is no doubt in my mind that if he had his own kingdom, he would invade mine. If he had a fortune, he would only use it to raise an army to take my throne. He was born to greatness, she says. He was born a third son, Edward says, finally roused to tell her the truth. He can only rule England if I die, and my son and heir dies too, then my second son, Richard, and then my new son, George. Is that what you would have preferred, Mother? Do you wish me dead, and my three precious sons too? Do you favor George so much? Do you ill-wish me as his hired wizard did? Will you order ground glass in my meat and foxglove powder in my wine? No, she says, no, of course not. You are your father's son and heir, and you won your throne. Your son must come after you. But George is my son. I feel for him. Edward grits his teeth on a hasty reply, and turns to the fireplace and stands in silence, his shoulders hunched. We all wait in silence until the king finally speaks. All I can do for you, and for him, is to let him choose the means of his death. He has to die, but if he wants a French swordsman, I will send for one. It doesn't have to be the headsman for him. It can be poison if he wants it. He can take it in private. It can be a dagger on his dinner table, and he can do it himself, and it will be in private. There will be no crowd, not even witnesses. It can be in his room in the tower if he wishes. He can put himself to bed and open his wrists. There can be nobody there but the priest if he wishes. She gasps. She did not expect this. I am very still, watching them both. I did not think Edward would go so far. He looks at her stricken face. Mother, I am sorry for your loss. She is white. You will forgive him. You can see yourself that I cannot. I command it. I am your mother. You will obey me. I am the king. He cannot oppose me. He must die. She rounds on me. This is your doing. I spread out my hands. George has killed himself, Lady Mother. You cannot blame me, nor Edward. He leaves the king no choice. He is a traitor to our rule, and a danger to us and our children. You know what must happen to claimants to the throne. This is the way of the House of York. She is silent. She walks to the window and leans her head against the thick glass. I look at her back and at the rigid set of her shoulders, and wonder what it must be like to know that your son will die. I once promised her the pain of a mother who knows that she has lost her son. I see it now. I cannot bear it, she says, her voice strained with grief. This is my son, my dearest son. How can you take him from me? I would rather have died myself than see this day. This is my George, my most precious son. I cannot believe you would send him to his death. I am sorry, Edward says grimly, but I can see no way out of this but his death. He can choose the means, she confirms. You will not expose him to the headsman. He can choose the means, but he has to die, Edward says. He has made it a matter of him or me. Of course he will have to die. She turns without another word and goes from the room. For a moment only, I am sorry for her. George, the fool, chooses a fool's death. He wants to be drowned in a barrel of wine. Anthony, my brother, comes from the Privy Council meeting to find me rocking in the chair in the nursery, my baby George in my arms, and wishing that it was all over and my little prince's namesake was dead and gone. You are trying to be funny. No, I think he is trying to be funny. What does he mean? I suppose what he says. He wants to be drowned in a barrel of wine. He really said that? He really means it? I have come from the Privy Council just now. He wants to drown in wine if he has to die. A sot's death, I say, hating the thought of it. I suppose that is his joke against his brother. I raise my baby to my shoulder and stroke his back, as if I would shield him from the cruelty of the world. I can think of worse ways to die, Anthony observes. I can think of better. I would rather be hanged than held down in wine. He shrugs his shoulders. Perhaps he thinks he can make mock of Edward and of the death sentence. Perhaps he thinks he will force Edward to forgive him rather than execute this drunkard's end. Perhaps he thinks the church will protest and cause a delay and he will get away. Not this time, I say. His sot's luck has run out. He might as well have a drunkard's end. Where will they do it? In his chamber, at the Tower of London. I shudder. God forgive him, I say quietly. That is an awful way to die. The headsman does it, leaving his axe to one side but wearing his black mask over his face. He is a big man, with strong, big hands, and he takes his apprentice with him. The two of them roll a barrel of Malmsey wine into George's room, and George the fool makes a joke of it and laughs with his mouth open wide as if already gasping for air, as his face bleaches white with fear. They lever open the lid and find a box for George to stand on so he can lean over the top of the barrel and see his frightened face reflected back at him in the slopping surface of the wine. The smell of it fills the room. He mutters amen to the prayers of the priest, as if he does not know what he is hearing. He puts his head down to the ruby surface of the wine, as if he were putting his head on the block, and he sucks great gulps of it, as if he would drink the danger away. Then he thrusts out his hands in the signal of assent, and the two men take his head, and holding him by the hair and the collar, plunge him down below the surface, half lifting him from the floor so his legs kick as if he is swimming, and the wine is slopped on the floor as he writhes, trying to escape. The wine cascades around their feet as the air bubbles out of him in great, retching whoops. The priest steps back from the red puddle and goes on reading the last rites, his voice steady and reverent, while the two executioners hold the flailing head of the most stupid son of York deep into the barrel, until his feet hang slack, and there are no more bubbles of air, and the room smells like an old tap room. That night, at midnight, I get up from my bed in the Palace of Westminster and go to my dressing room. On the top of a long cupboard for my furs is a little box with my private things. I open it. Inside is an old locket of silver so tarnished with age that it is black as ebony. I open the catch, and there is the old scrap of paper, torn from the bottom of my father's letter. On it, written in blood, my blood, is the name George, Duke of Clarence. I screw the paper up in my fingers, and I throw it on the embers of the fire, and watch it twist in the heat of the ashes, and then suddenly spring into flame. So go, I say, as George's name goes up in smoke, and my curse on him is completed. But let you be the last York who dies in the Tower of London. Let it end here, as I promised my mother it would. Let it finish here. I wish I had remembered, as she taught me, that it is easier to unleash evil than call it back again. Any fool can blow up a wind, but who can know where it will blow or when it will stop? Summer, 1478. I have my boy Edward, my son Sir Richard Grey, and my brother Anthony come to my private apartments for me to say goodbye to them. I cannot bear to let them go from me in public. I don't want to be seen to weep as they leave. I bend to hold Edward close, as if I would never be parted from him, and he looks at me with his warm brown eyes, holds my face in his little hands and says, "Don't cry, Mama. There is nothing to cry about. I shall come again next Christmas, and you can visit me at Ludlow, you know." "I know," I say. "And if you bring George, then I will teach him how to ride," he promises me. "And you can put young Richard into my keeping, you know." "I know." I try to speak clearly, but the tears are in my voice. Richard hugs me around the waist. He is as tall as me now, a young man. "I will care for him," he says. "You must visit us. Bring all my brothers and sisters. Come for the summer." I will," I say, and turn to my brother Anthony. "Trust us to take care of ourselves," he says, before I can even start the list of things that make me fearful. "And I will bring him safe home to you next year, and I will not leave him, not even for Jerusalem. I will not leave him till he commands me to go, all right?" I nod, blinking away my tears. There is something that troubles me at the thought of Edward letting Anthony go from him. It is as if a shadow has fallen on us. I don't know why, I just always fear for him so much whenever I have to say goodbye to the three of you. I can hardly bear to let him go. "I will guard him with my life," Anthony promises. "He is as dear to me as life itself. No harm will come to him while he is in my keeping. You have my word." He bows and turns to the door. Edward, beside him, does a mirror copy of the graceful gesture. Richard, my son, puts his fist to his chest in the salute that means, "I love you." "Be happy," Anthony says. "I have your boy safe." Then they are gone from me. Spring, 1479. My boy George, always a slight baby, starts to fail before he reaches his second birthday. The physicians know nothing. The ladies of the nursery can suggest only gruel and milk to be fed hourly. We try it, but he grows no stronger. Elizabeth, his 13-year-old sister, plays with him every day, takes his little hands and helps him to walk on his thin legs, makes up a story for every mouthful of food that he eats. But even she sees that he is not thriving. He does not grow, and his little arms and legs are like sticks. "Can we get a physician from Spain?" I ask Edward. "Anthony always says that the Moors have the wisest men." His face is weary with worry and sorrow for this, a precious son. "You can get anyone you like from anywhere," he says. "But Elizabeth, my love, find your courage. He is a frail little boy, and he was a tiny baby. You have done well to keep him with us this far." "Don't say that," I say quickly, shaking my head. "He will get better. The spring will come, and then the summer. He will get better in the summer, for sure." I spend hours in the nursery, with my little boy on my lap, dripping gruel into his little mouth, holding his chest to my ear so I can hear the faint patter of his heart. They tell me that we are blessed to have two strong sons. The succession to the throne of York is surely secure. I say nothing in reply to these fools. I am not nursing him for the sake of York. I am nursing him for love. I do not want him to thrive to be a prince. I want him to thrive to be a strong boy. This is my baby boy. I cannot bear to lose him as I lost his sister. I cannot bear that he should die in my arms as she died in my mother's arms and they went away together. I haunt the nursery during the day, and even at night I come to watch him sleep. And I am sure he is growing no stronger. He is asleep on my lap one day in March, and I am rocking him in the chair and humming, without knowing I am doing so, a little song, a Burgundian lullaby half-remembered from my childhood. The song ends, and there is silence. I still the rocking of the chair, and everything is quiet. I put my ear to his little chest to hear the beating of his heart. And I cannot hear the beating of his heart. I put my cheek to his nose, his mouth, to feel the warmth of his breath. There is no flutter of breath. He is still warm and soft in my arms, warm and soft as a little bird. But my George has gone. I have lost my son. I hear the sound of the lullaby again, softly as the wind, and I know that Melusina is rocking him now, and my boy George has gone. I have lost my son. They tell me that I still have my boy Edward, that I am lucky in that my handsome boy of 8 years old is so strong and grows so well. They tell me to be glad of Richard, his 5-year-old brother. I smile, for I am glad of both of my boys. But that makes no difference to my loss of George, my little George with his blue eyes and his tuft of blonde hair. 5 months later, I am in confinement awaiting the birth of another child. I don't expect a boy. I don't imagine that one child can replace another. But little Catherine comes at just the right time to comfort us, and there is a York princess in the cradle again, and the York nursery is busy as usual. A year later, and I have another baby, my little girl Bridget. I think this will be our last, I say regretfully to Edward, when I come out of confinement. I had been afraid that he would note that I was growing older, but instead he smiles at me, as if we were still young lovers, and kisses my hand. No man could have asked for more, he says sweetly to me, and no queen has ever labored harder. You have given me a great family, my love, and I am glad this will be our last. You don't want another boy? He shakes his head. I want to take you for pleasure, and hold you in my arms for desire. I want you to know that it is your kiss that I want, not another heir to the throne. You can know that I love you quite for yourself when I come to your bed, and not as the York's broodmare. I tilt back my head and look at him under my eyelashes. You think to bed me for love and not for children? Isn't that sin? His arm comes around my waist and his palm cups my breast. I shall make sure that it feels richly sinful, he promises me. April, 1483. The weather is cold and unseasonal, and the rivers run high. We are at Westminster for the Feast of Easter, and I look from my window at the fullness and the fast flow of the river, and think of my son Edward beyond the great waters of the Severn River. Far away from me. It is as if England is a country of intersecting waterways, lakes and streams and rivers. Melusina must be everywhere. This is a country made in her element. My husband, Edward, a man of the land, has a whim to go fishing, and takes himself out for the day, and comes home soaking wet and merry. He insists that we eat the salmon that he caught in the river for our dinner, and it is borne into the dining room at shoulder height with a fanfare, a royal catch. That night he is feverish, and I scold him for getting wet and cold, as if he was still a boy and could take such risks with his health. The next day he is worse, and he gets up for a little while but then goes back to bed. He is too tired. The next day the physician says that he should be bled, and Edward swears that they may not touch him. I tell the doctors that it shall be as the king insists, but I go to his room when he is sleeping, and I look at his flushed face to reassure myself that this is nothing more than a passing illness. This is not the plague or a serious fever. He is a strong man in good health. He can take a chill and throw it off within a week. He gets no better, and now he starts to complain of gripping pains in the belly and a terrible flush of heat. Within a week, the court is in fear, and I am in a state of silent terror. The doctors are useless. They don't even know what is wrong with him. They don't know what has caused his fever. They don't know what will cure it. He can keep nothing down. He vomits everything he eats, and he is fighting the pain in his belly as if it were a new war. I keep a vigil in his room, my daughter Elizabeth beside me, nursing him with two wise women whom I trust. Hastings, the friend of his boyhood and his partner in every enterprise, including the stupid, stupid fishing trip, keeps his vigil in the outer room. The shore whore has taken to living on her knees at the altar in Westminster Abbey, they tell me, in an agony of fear for the man she loves. Let me see him, William Hastings implores me. I turn a cold face to him. No, he is sick. He needs no companion for whoring or drinking or gambling, so he has no need of you. His health has been ruined by you and all them like you. I will nurse him to health now, and if I have my way, when he is well, he will not see you again. Let me see him, he says. He does not even defend himself against my anger. All I want is to see him. I can't bear not to see him. Wait like a dog out here, I say cruelly, or go back to the shore whore and tell her that she can service you now, for the king has finished with you both. I'll wait, he says. He will ask for me. He will want to see me. He knows I am waiting to see him. He knows I am out here. I walk past him to the king's bedchamber, and I close the door so he cannot even glimpse the man he loves, fighting for breath in the big four-poster bed. Edward looks up when I come in. Elizabeth. I go to him and hold his hand. Yes, love. You remember I came home to you and told you I had been afraid. I remember. I am afraid again. You will get well, I whisper urgently. You will get well, my husband. He nods, and his eyes close for a moment. Is Hastings outside? No, I say. He smiles. I want to see him. Not now, I say. I stroke his head. It is burning hot. I take up a towel and soak it with lavender water and gently bathe his face. You are not strong enough to see anyone now. Elizabeth, fetch him, and fetch every one of my Privy Council who is in the palace. Send for Richard, my brother. For a moment, I think I have caught his sickness, as my belly turns over with such a pain. Then I realize this is fear. You don't need to see them, Edward. All you need to do is rest and grow strong. Fetch them, he says. I turn and say a sharp word to the nurse, and she runs to the door and tells the guard. At once the message goes out all through the court that the king has summoned his advisers, and everyone knows that he must be dying. I go to the window and stand with my back to the view of the river. I don't want to see the water. I don't want to see the glimmer of a mermaid's tail. I don't want to hear Melusina singing to warn of a death. The lords file into the room. Stanley, Norfolk, Hastings, Cardinal Thomas Boucher, my brothers, my cousins, my brothers-in-law, half a dozen others. All the great men of the kingdom. Men who have been with my husband from the days of his earliest challenge. Or men like Stanley, who are always perfectly aligned to the winning side. I look at them stony-faced, and they bow to me, grim-faced. The women have propped Edward up so he can see the council. Hastings' eyes are filled with tears, his face twisted with pain. Edward reaches out a hand to him, and they grip each other as if Hastings would hold him to life. I fear I have not long, Edward says. His voice is a rasping whisper. No, whispers Hastings. Don't say it, no. Edward turns his head and speaks to them all. I leave a young son. I had hoped to see him grow to a man. I had hoped to leave you with a man for king. Instead, I have to trust you to care for my boy. I have my fist to my mouth to stop myself from crying out. No, I say. Hastings, Edward says. Lord, and all of you, and Elizabeth, my queen. I step to his bedside, and he takes my hand in his, joins it with Hastings's, as if he were making us wed. You have to work together. All of you have to forget your enmities, your rivalries, your hatreds. You all have scores to settle. You all have wrongs you can't forget. But you have to forget. You have to be as one, to keep my son safe and see him to the throne. I ask you this. I demand this of you from my deathbed. Will you do it? I think of all the years that I have hated Hastings, Edward's dearest friend and companion, the partner for all his drinking and whoring bouts, the friend at his side in battle. I remember how Sir William Hastings, from the very first moment, despised and looked down on me from his high horse when I stood at the roadside. How he opposed the rise of my family, and always and again urged the king to listen to other advisers and employ other friends. I see him look at me, and even though tears are pouring down his face, his eyes are hard. He thinks I stood at the roadside and cast a spell on a young boy for his ruin. He will never understand what happened that day between a young man and a young woman. There was a magic, and the name of it was love. I will work with Hastings for my son's safety, I say. I will work with all of you, and forget all wrongs, to put my son safely on the throne. I too, says Hastings, and then they all say, one after another, and I, and I, and I. My brother Richard is to be his guardian, Edward says. I flinch, and would pull my hand away, but Hastings has it in a tight grip. As you wish, sire, he says, looking hard at me. He knows that I resent Richard and the power of the North that he can command. Anthony, my brother, I say in a whisper, prompting the king. No, Edward says stubbornly. Richard, Duke of Gloucester, is to be his guardian and protector of the realm till Prince Edward takes his throne. No, I whisper. If I could only get the king alone, I could tell him that with Anthony as protector, we Riverses could hold the country safe. I don't want my power threatened by Richard. I want my son surrounded by my family. I don't want any one of the York affinity in the new government that I will make around my son. I want this to be a Rivers boy on England's throne. Do you so swear? Edward says. I do, they all say. Hastings looks at me. Do you swear? He asks. Do you swear that just as we promised to put your son on the throne, you promised to accept Richard, Duke of Gloucester, as protector? Of course I do not. Richard is no friend of mine, and he commands half of England already. Why would I trust him to put my son on the throne when he is a York prince himself? Why would he not take the chance to seize the throne for himself? And he has a son, a boy by little Anne Neville, a boy who could be Prince of Wales in place of my own prince. Why would Richard, who has fought half a dozen battles for Edward, not fight one more for himself? Edward's face is grey with fatigue. Swear it, Elizabeth, he whispers. For my sake. For Edward's sake. Do you think it will make Edward safe? He nods. It is the only way. He will be safe if you and the lords agree, if Richard agrees. I am trapped. I swear it, I say. Edward releases his hard grip on our hands and falls back on his pillows. Hastings howls like a dog and puts his face down in the cover, and Edward's hand finds its way blindly to touch his old friend's head as in a blessing. The others file out. Hastings and I are left on either side of the bed, and the king dying between us. I have no time for grief. No time to measure my loss. Inside, my heart is breaking for the man I love, the only man whom I ever loved in all my life, the only man whom I will ever love. Edward, the boy who rode up to me when I waited for him. My beloved. I have no time to think about this, when my son's future and my family's prospects depend on my being hard of will and dry-eyed. That night, I write to my brother, Anthony. The king is dead. Bring the new King Edward to London at all possible speed. Bring as many men as you can command as a royal guard. We will need them. Edward foolishly named Richard, Duke of Gloucester, as protector. Richard hates you and me equally for the king's love and our own power. We must crown Edward at once and defend against the Duke, who will never give up the protectorate without a fight. Recruit men as you march, and collect the weapons that are stored in hiding on the way. Prepare yourself for battle, to defend our heir. I will delay announcing the death as long as I can, so Richard, who is still in the north, does not know what is happening yet. So hurry, Elizabeth. What I don't know is that Hastings is writing to Richard, blotting the page with his tears, but legible enough, to say that the Rivers family are arming around their prince, and that if Richard wants to take up his role as protector, if he wants to guard the young Prince Edward against the boy's own rapacious family, he had better come at once, with as many men from his heartlands of the north as he can muster, before the prince is kidnapped by his own kin. He writes, "The king left all under your protection, goods, heir, realm. Secure the person of our sovereign, Lord Edward V, and get you to London before the Riverses flood us out." What I don't know, and what I don't allow myself to think, is that having learned to fear the constant wars for the throne of England, I am just starting one on my own account, and that at stake this time is the inheritance, and even the life, of my beloved son. He kidnaps him. Richard moves faster and is better armed and more determined than any of us could have imagined. He moves as fast and as decisively as Edward would have done. And he is as ruthless. He waylays my son on his journey to London, dismisses the men from Wales who were loyal to him and to me, arrests my brother Anthony, my son Richard Grey, and our cousin Thomas Vaughan, and takes Edward into his so-called safe-keeping. My boy is not quite 13, in God's name. My boy is still a boy of only 12. His voice is still fluting. His chin is smooth as a girl's. He has the softest fair down on his upper lip that you can only see when his face is in profile, against the light. And when Richard sends his loyal servants away, his uncle whom he idolizes, the half-brother he loves, he defends them with a little quaver in his voice. He says that he is certain that his father would have placed only good men about him, and that he wants to keep them in his service. He is only a boy. He has to stand up to a battle-hardened man who is determined to do wrong. When Richard says that my own brother Anthony, who has been my boy's friend and guardian and protector for all his life, and my youngest grandson, Richard, must leave his side, my little boy tries to defend them. He says that he is certain that his Uncle Anthony is a good man and a fine guardian. He says that his half-brother Richard has been a kinsman and a comrade to him, that he knows that his Uncle Anthony has never done anything but that suits the great knight, the chivalrous knight that he is, But Duke Richard tells him that all will be resolved, and in the meantime he and the Duke of Buckingham, my former ward, whom I married against his will to my sister Catherine, and who now turns up in this surprising company, will be the prince's companions to London. He is only a little boy. He has always been gently guarded. He does not know how to stand up to his Uncle Richard, dressed in black and with a face like thunder, 2,000 men in his train and ready to fight. So he lets his Uncle Anthony go. He lets his brother Richard go. How could he save them? He cries bitterly. They tell me that. He cries like a child when no one will obey him. But he lets them go. May, 1483. Elizabeth, my 17-year-old daughter, comes running through the shouting and the chaos of Westminster Palace.
Mother! Lady Mother, what's happening?
We're going into sanctuary, I snap. Hurry! Get everything you want and all the clothes for the children, and make sure they bring the carpets out of the royal rooms and the tapestries. Get all that taken into Westminster Abbey. We are going into sanctuary again. And your jewelry box, and your furs. And then go through the royal apartments and make sure they are stripping them of everything of value.
Why? She asks, her pale mouth trembling. What has happened now? What about baby?
Your brother, the king, has been taken by his uncle, the Lord Protector, I say. My words are like knives, and I see them strike her. She admires her Uncle Richard. She always has done. She was hoping he would care for all of us. Protect us, in truth. Your father's will has put my enemy in charge of my son. We will see what kind of a Lord Protector he makes, but we had better see it from safety. We go into sanctuary today, right this minute.
Mother,
she dances on the spot with fear.
Should we not wait? Should we not consult the Privy Council? Should we not wait here for baby? What if Duke Richard is just bringing baby safely to us? What if he is doing as he should, as Lord Protector, protecting baby?
He is King Edward to you, not baby any more, I say fiercely, and even to me. And let me tell you, child, that only fools wait when their enemies are coming to see if they may prove to be friends. We will be as safe as I can make us, in sanctuary, and we will take your brother, Prince Richard, and keep him safe too. And when the Lord Protector comes to London with his private army, he can persuade me that it is safe to come out. I speak bravely to my brave girl, now a young woman with her own life blighted by this sudden fall from being a Princess of England to a girl in hiding. But in truth, we are at a very low ebb when we barricade the door of St. Margaret's Crypt at Westminster, and we are alone. My brother Lionel, Bishop of Salisbury, my grown son Thomas Grey, my little son Richard, and my girls, Elizabeth, Cecily, Anne, Catherine, and Bridget. When we were last here, I was big with my first boy, with every reason to hope that he would lay claim to the throne of England one day. My mother was alive, and was my companion and my greatest friend, and nobody could be afraid for long when my mother was scheming for them, and making her spells and laughing at her own ambition. My husband was alive in exile, planning his return. I never doubted that he would come. I never doubted that he would be victorious. I always knew that he never lost a battle. I knew he would come. I knew he would win. I knew he would rescue us. I knew there were bad days, but I hoped for better. Now we are here again. But this time, it is hard to hope. In this season of early summer, which has always before been my favorite, filled with picnics and jousts and parties, the shade of the crypt is oppressive. It is like being buried alive. In truth, there is not much cause for hope. My boy is in enemy hands, my mother is long gone, and my husband is dead. No handsome, tall man is going to hammer on the door and block the light as he comes in, calling my name. My son, who was a baby then, is a young boy of 12 now, and in the hands of our enemy. My girl, Elizabeth, who played then so sweetly with her sisters when we were last confined, is now 17. She turns her pale face to me and asks what we are going to do. Last time we waited secure in the knowledge that if we could just survive, we would be rescued. This time, there are no certainties. For nearly a week, I listen at the tiny window set into the front door. From dawn till dusk, I am peering through the grille, straining my ears to hear what people are doing, for the sound of the streets. When I turn from the door, I go to the river and look out on the boats passing by, watching for the royal barge, listening for Melusina. Every day I send out messengers for news of my brother and my son, and to speak to the lords who should be rising to defend us, whose liveries should be arming for us. And on the fifth day I hear it, a rising swell of noise, the cheering of the apprentice lads, and another sound beneath it, a deeper sound, a booing. I can hear the rattle of harness and the sound of many horses' hooves. It is the army of Richard, Duke of Gloucester, my husband's brother, the man he trusted with our safety, entering my husband's capital city to a mixed reception. When I look out of the window at the river, there is a chain of his boats around Westminster Palace, a floating barricade holding us captive. Nobody can come in or out. I hear the clatter of a cavalry charge and some shouting. I start to wonder, if I had armed the city against him, declared war in the first moment, could I have stood against him now? But then I think, and what about my boy, Edward, in his uncle's train? What about my brother, Anthony, and my son, Richard Grey, held hostage for my good behaviour? And yet again, perhaps I have nothing to fear. I simply don't know. My boy is either a young king, processing in high honour to his coronation, or a kidnapped child. I don't even know which for sure. I go to bed with that question haunting me, like the beating of a drum. I lie down in my clothes, and I do not sleep at all. I know that somewhere, not far from me tonight, my son is lying sleepless too. I am restless, like a woman tormented, to be with him, to see him, to tell him that he is safe with me again. I cannot believe, daughter of Melusina as I am, that I cannot squeeze through the bars of the window and simply swim to him. He is my boy. Perhaps he is afraid. Maybe he is in danger. How can I not be with him? But I have to lie still and wait for the sky to turn from deepest black to grey in the small panes of the window before I allow myself to rise up and walk down the crypt to the door and open the spy hole to look out and see the quiet streets. Then I realize that no one has armed to protect my boy Edward. No one is going to rescue him. No one is going to liberate me. They may have booed as the Lord Protector marched in at the head of his army with my son in his train. They may have raised a little riot and fought a little running scrap. But they are not arming this morning and storming his castle. Last night, I was the only one in all of London wakeful, worrying about the little king for all the long hours. The city is waiting to see what the Lord Protector will do. Everything hinges on this. Is Richard, Duke of Gloucester, the beloved, loyal brother of the late king, going to fulfill his brother's dying command and put his son on the throne? Is he, loyal as ever, going to play his part as Lord Protector and guard his nephew till the day of his coronation? Or is Richard, Duke of Gloucester, false as any Yorkist, going to take the power his brother gave him, disinherit his nephew, and put the crown on his own head, and name his own son Prince of Wales? Nobody knows what Duke Richard might do, and many, as always, want only to be on the winning side. Everyone will have to wait and see. Only I would strike him down now if I could, just to be on the side of safety. I go to the low windows, and I stare down at the river which flows by so close that I